Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we're joined by investigative journalist Jane Acree, the Mesh Medical Device News Desk. We'll be talking about issues surrounding medical mesh, particularly in women, and some problems that have developed over the last decade. In the second part of the show today, we'll be joined by Ken Burrows, professor at San Francisco State University. We'll be talking about the Gandhi King season of nonviolence. Please stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. For the first segment of the show today, we're joined by investigative journalist Jane Acree. She has been working on Mesh Medical Device News Desk, and she has been working on some of the serious problems that are associated with things like pelvic mesh. And she's going to talk to us for a half hour today in the show about why this story is so important. And also, we're going to talk about how it's not being widely covered, which is, of course, how it got on our radar here at Project Censored. And here is Peter to introduce Jane Acree to you today. Peter?
Jane Acree has been a reporter since 1980 and worked in mainstream media for more than 20 years until she did a story about Monsanto and its bovine growth hormone. That would be her last TV story because she and her husband sued Fox News for trying to manipulate the story and falsifying it. The conflict ended up in court fight, which could be seen in the film The Corporation. And since 2011, she's been working on the Mesh Medical Device News Desk to delve into largely untold story about medical mesh. It's used for women to shore up pelvic organs and in men for hernias, and it's made of plastic. So this is a very important story that has not been covered. It's certainly a censored story. Jane, welcome.
Thank you, Peter and Mickey. It is so wonderful to be here, and thank you for what you do as well. I'm a big admirer.
Well, let's just start right out with the basics. What is pelvic mesh, and what's it used for?
Pelvic mesh is made of polypropylene, and polypropylene you might be familiar with is indoor-outdoor carpets, the top of a Tic Tac box. It's a pretty cheap and common plastic. Pelvic mesh is used when women have, either through aging or childbirth, you know, their pelvic organs begin to sag and want to come out of the body. So the mesh is cut through the vagina, literally, with an X-Acto knife. If you ever want to see the operation, go to YouTube and be prepared for what you see. And they thread it in there, and they will shore up the bladder or the urethra or the pelvic floor or anything like that and sew it in or staple it into the body. And, you know, in hernias, it's sewn in, basically. But it's a nice polypropylene with raw edges, and you can imagine how that does in the body. Not too well.
So what are some of the complications that arise?
Well, you know, once it gets in there, it starts a bacterial love fest there and often causes biofilms to form. Bacterial contamination, that a biofilm will protect that contamination, so it cannot be addressed with antibiotics. The mesh shrinks with time and can take with it nerves. It causes chronic infections, chronic pain. This is not in everybody, but in many people, maybe as many as a third of the women it's implanted in. Autoimmune issues. And these things just do not resolve over time. They often get worse with time. I mean, I talk to women all the time that are living on oxycodone or morphine and can't get out of their beds because their lives as they knew it are over for this simple, minimally invasive procedure.
We're speaking with Jane Acree, independent journalist, longtime investigative reporter. In fact, Project Censored Award winner going back to 2003, and we might bring that up here in a little bit because it's partially germane to why we know you from before, Jane Acree. But I wanted to jump to this issue regarding the pelvic mesh. Is this FDA approved?
That's a really good thing that people need to understand. If they understand nothing else about this, the FDA and its wisdom has an approval process that requires clinical trials for drugs, for example. That does not apply to medical devices. 95% of them skate through with an exchange of paperwork based on the integrity of the mesh makers. Yeah. And they do not require clinical trials to assure the public of safety and efficacy. It's simply an exchange of paperwork. It's been called a fast-track system. And that's, you know, maybe because the FDA just really doesn't have the personnel to do that. But if your medical device, and that includes implantable medical devices, has been approved by the 510K approval system, watch out. You know, if it's new on the market, run. Don't walk, run. And that's what mesh has been approved under. It's considered class 2 of moderate risk, even though it is permanently implanted. So it's absurd on the face of it. It's just ridiculous. But that's the way it operates, you know, like the way the FDA operates with genetically engineered food. And it's just, it's ridiculous.
510K procedure versus trials and scientific process. What does that mean? A bureaucrat just says, yeah, looks fine to me.
They have to apply, just send paperwork in, and the main criteria is that this device is the substantial equivalent, and that's the language, of something that's already in the marketplace. In the Netherlands, they just did a film, and this is brilliant. They took the kind of netting that, you know, you use to carry oranges with, the orange netting, and they went to the regulatory authorities there, and they said, this is a medical device, and they went through the proper paperwork and procedure to have it approved as a medical device. It was. An orange bag was approved as pelvic mesh. Basically, their system is based on our system. It's an exchange of paperwork. It takes 60 to 90 days. It costs $5,000, and that's it.
So this is literally being inserted to millions of people, men as well, correct?
Yeah. Pelvic mesh came from hernia mesh, so it's the same mesh. It's polypropylene. And doctors today are selling women on it by saying, oh, it's different mesh. We don't use that anymore. It's been recalled. That's not true. Ask your doctor if he wants to sell you on this procedure, is this polypropylene? And that's part of the problem. There are some biologic composites and all, but largely they're still using this good old polypropylene mesh.
Well, Jane Acree, so other countries are doing this too, and the same corporations are behind this?
Well, you know, we sell our medical devices overseas. So, I mean, I get calls from, you know, Finland and Australia, Canada, of course. We just export our misery.
Well, Jane Acree, I wanted to go back to something here briefly. We can certainly get into more about specific issues with the pelvic mesh. But I wanted to bring up, you know, we just brought up the FDA here a couple times.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to, you know, again, I could not help but remember well over a decade ago that one of the top censored stories was about your work at Fox News. Uh-huh. In Tampa. That also involved FDA. It involved Monsanto. Can you remind our listeners how you got on the Project Censored radar and the work that you did then and how it does seem to overlap with what you're doing now?
Yeah, the story was basically about BGH, bovine growth hormone, made by Monsanto, a genetically engineered hormone that's injected into the cows so that they'll produce more milk. It's about money. It's about making money. That'd be fine, except that the milk is altered. It had more IGF-1 in it, insulin-like growth factor, which causes cells to proliferate. And we had several scientists on camera saying, you know, there's a real concern about cancer here. And Monsanto was the heavy-handed one and hired a very expensive law firm and got the story basically killed. But, you know, in the meantime, Fox was trying to tell us to make the story untrue. They could have killed it. They're allowed to do that. Unfortunately, it's true. But they can't start going in and manipulating the facts that we had uncovered. So we filed a lawsuit against them as whistleblowers under Florida employment law, took them to trial, took Fox News to trial. You know, News Corp is what it's called. I won my case, and my ex-husband, Steve, lost his, even though the facts were the same. Fox immediately appealed. They wanted $1.7 million from us to cover their court costs, which is really, really laughable. They got the appeal, and our victory in court was overturned, and we ended up having to pay them.
Yeah, that's incredibly tragic. That's certainly a distortion of justice.
It's unbelievable.
In that case. And one of the interpretations, of course, that comes out of that is that, and a lot of the other major media, the corporate media, filed Friends of the Court briefs, basically arguing that they have the right to do this. Some have interpreted it as the media can lie in contravention of the 1934 Telecommunications Act. Is that true?
Yes, that's absolutely true. You know, I sort of thought, I guess I'm naive, I thought journalists would rally around us and say, yes, that's right, you can't start altering the facts of the story as we uncover it. But, you know, these major news organizations said basically, stay out of our newsrooms, we want to be able to do whatever we want to do, and we don't want to have anybody overseeing it. So it was a big disappointment to me, and frankly, that was my last mainstream media job.
Well, indeed, and the head of Fox Tampa said that they paid, you know, some billions of dollars, so they'll tell you what the news is. I mean, there were so many striking things that came out of that. If people were more interested, though, it's in the first Project Censored film, actually. But, you know, Michael Taylor was the Monsanto man back in the day, right? That was one of the people?
That's right.
And he's back in the Monsanto Obama administration.
Funny how that door revolves, isn't it?
It sure is, and if you pay attention to this stuff long enough, it certainly seems to come round full circle. Again, these are very interesting relationships, and it also shows the clear manipulation, the conflicts of interest. You know, the very things that you were reporting about back in the 90s and early 2000s.
Right.
And
right.
You're doing it again now, right, with this issue of the pelvic mesh. You're really up against some pretty serious powers here. How are you faring getting the word out?
You're right. I mean, it's Johnson & Johnson, Boston Scientific, C.R. Bard, American Medical Systems. These are big, big, big companies. And I've noticed that there's just a big sleeping media out there. And I have tried. I mean, I send out news releases. We've gotten a little bit of publicity. Some of the women gathered at the federal courthouse in Charleston, West Virginia, where there's 86,000 of these lawsuits, more than any other mass tort. And we got a little bit of coverage, but, you know, I don't understand. I guess I do understand, but I think part of it is that journalists think we're going to talk about women's pelvises and vaginas, and oh my gosh, we can't talk about that, even though we show women's pelvises all the time.
Indeed.
In one form or another, bikini clad usually.
So, Jane, you're in the business now of protecting human health again, and this mesh, medical mesh devices, have created close to 100,000 lawsuits for damages, correct?
That's correct.
And people are winning. Are they winning money? What's happening?
They're winning a $13.5 million judgment against Johnson & Johnson in a Philadelphia court. Of that, $10 million in punitive damages. In December, the same court, $12.5 million for the plaintiff, with $7 million in punitive damages against Johnson & Johnson. I mean, the juries don't like what they're hearing. They don't like that these companies knew what was going on before they approved this stuff. Their own scientists were saying, you know, this might not work. We're going to have complications. We don't really know how to take it out of women because it's a permanent implant. They ignored that. They ran through the stop signs. The latest is Boston Scientific is found to have gone to China when their U.S. supply of polypropylene resin dried up, and they smuggled into the country counterfeit mesh polypropylene resin from China. China has got absolutely no health regulations whatsoever. That's the latest chapter. Unbelievable. Bard, when they knew they were having a problem with their supplier, they formed a dummy company to be the go-between so the supplier wouldn't know that they were using their resin for permanent implants, because it says on the material safety data sheet, which accompanies any chemical, do not use for medical devices that are to be permanently implanted. So they had to protect themselves by creating this dummy company. This is criminal activity.
Indeed, it is.
It's done every day by these corporations, and the juries hear it, and they don't like it.
Well, Jane Acree, we have to take a brief musical break here, but when we come back, we want to talk more specifically about some of these issues, and also we want to be sure to tell people where they can find out more about this important work that you're doing. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We'll be back with Jane Acree after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Thank you. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're joined today in the first part of the program by journalist Jane Acree. She's a longtime reporter, award-winning journalist. In fact, Project Censored honored her work years ago for the work that she did exposing the Fox-Monsanto connection and growth hormones in dairy products and so forth. She certainly paid a price for that, was not protected under whistleblower clause in Florida. But Jane Acree didn't quit. She kept speaking truth to power and has been doing a lot of reporting and research on medical mesh. And that's what we're focusing on today, is we're looking at what the issues are surrounding that. And we talked earlier about, you mentioned that there are many lawsuits, 100,000 lawsuits, 86,000 filed in one court claiming injury. Can you talk again a little bit more specifically about what exactly are the injuries and what is being done about it? What's coming out of these processes, these legal trials and so forth, in terms of public awareness?
Well, the injuries are usually permanent. They involve chronic infection, chronic pain. Women have to go on pain medication. Doctors don't know what to do with them, so they turn their back on the women and say, you know, I can't help you. Here, go to pain management, as if this were a way of life that would be okay. They are winning when they go to trial, for the most part. I would say 95% of these trials are being won by the women, but then the companies immediately appeal. And so only one case, the first one in Bakersfield, California, has actually been settled, and that was $3.5 million against C.R. Bard, a pelvic mesh maker. There's another $11.1 million that is about to have its final round in the appeals court, and that may settle soon, and they may finally see some money. But that particular woman's had 20 operations to try to get this mesh out.
So it can't be removed very easily, apparently, and there may not be a
substitute. It really can't be removed. If you look at some of the pictures of this stuff, it starts to shred and migrate in the body and cause this chronic inflammatory response around the mesh particles. And the mesh shrinkage, it takes nerves in with it. I mean, it is just a minefield. I don't know of anyone who has had this who is now walking around and is feeling perfectly fine.
So given the conditions before the mesh is inserted, are there substitute ways of doing that without mesh?
Yes. That's a really good question. This, by the way, is a condition and it's not painful. Prolapse is not painful for the most part. In the old days, before Johnson & Johnson invented its polypropylene mesh, the doctors would go in and use sutures, kind of stitch up some of the areas. And that's the old-fashioned way, and sometimes that works best.
Well, Jane Acree, sounds like a prolapse of medical ethics. And these things are known. They're coming out in trials. What's going on in the medical, I'm going to use the word industry because that's what it kind of is in the United States for sure. What's going on among medical professionals surrounding this mesh in light of these discoveries and things you're bringing to light?
So many women tell me their doctor has now turned their back on them after they've had an unsuccessful surgery. And the medical societies, it's kind of interesting when you look at the American Urogynecologic Society, AUGS, for example. Their leadership is usually in a conflicted relationship with industry. Industry's not stupid. You know, they get these guys to be consultants or to be what's called preceptors to teach other doctors how to implant mesh. And that's what happens. They are still heralding the use of it, even though the FDA is now decided that they're going to reclassify the larger meshes into class 3, which is a high risk, and they're giving the medical manufacturers 30 months to prove the safety and efficacy after it's already been on the market for a decade. So it may be the death knell for pelvic organ prolapse, which is some of the larger meshes. And so the medical societies will have to change their talking points at that point. But, you know, there's still something called slings, which is for the urethra for incontinence. And they still call them the gold standard. It's just an amazing disconnect.
Jane Acree, what's resonating in my mind or reverberating, echoing, is that you said that there seems to be some understanding that there are problems with these materials, but they've already been in use for over a decade.
Yes.
Unfortunately, that seems to be far more the case. We hear it over and over. We know that GMOs certainly are being tested on people right now and have been for the past decade, right?
Right.
It seems very backward. It seems like we kind of grow up with this impression that the regulatory agencies and the oversight bodies are supposed to check all this stuff out before any of this gets to, I'm going to use this word too, the market. In your estimation, do you think that there's a serious profit motive? We're not saying it's intentionally inferior product to harm people, but once it's known that it's harmful, there seems to be a real foot dragging kind of thing happening because there's a lot of money going on here.
Absolutely. And also, I mean, I've just seen too many documents where the FDA on this issue looks to industry for its guidance. I mean, if they have a question, they bring in Johnson & Johnson folks to school them on what the issues are. One guy, a regulator who approves medical devices, a friend of mine who's quite active in this issue, he had a film that showed, made by Johnson & Johnson, it showed what mesh explants from a hernia, how they harden, and like a piece of plastic, and the doctor's banging it on the table. And this was a Johnson & Johnson film that they were showing doctors to promote their new softer mesh. Well, this guy, Bruce, decided to show this video to the FDA. And we've got the emails. The FDA regulator gets on the phone with an executive at Johnson & Johnson and says, what's this film all about? And they're conferring like their buddies and going to have lunch next week. It's just amazing what's going on.
So, Jane, if a pelvic organ prolapse occurs for a woman, the mesh has been used like a sling, literally, to hold the bladder in place.
Yes.
You're saying, though, that there's other procedures that can be as effective given the dangers of the mesh.
Yes, that's a good point, too. Exercise sometimes is very effective. Look at the Whole Woman site, wholewoman.com. There's something called a pessary, which is basically fitted in there that holds everything back. And as I said, there are other less invasive techniques where you basically suture up whatever needs to be sutured up. And that's what our grandmothers had, and, you know, it worked quite well.
What are your estimates on the likelihood if someone has a mesh implant of complications? And how many millions of these are in people's bodies today?
At some point, they were putting in about 250,000 a year. I tell you, one of the leading researchers, and he used to use mesh, and now he absolutely will not. His name is Dr. Shlomo Raz at UCLA. He's a urologist. He's in his 80s, I believe. And he says he will not use mesh because he's seen women come back to him 10 to 12 years after an implant with complications that he can't address. And imagine trying to get something out of your body that's been ingrowing for 10 or 12 years. So we don't really know if it's 5% of complication rate, 30% complication rate. The first year may not tell you enough. You might have a complication immediately. And the autoimmune, we haven't really even talked about that, but almost half, two-thirds of the women I'm talking about to have some sort of fibromyalgia, lupus, allergies, something that's happened to their body after the mesh implant. This plastic is living inside of them. Mesh is not inert, as the manufacturer said at one point, but we know that now, and scientists are saying it's not inert. It almost has its own life once inside your body.
So these mesh makers and Johnson & Johnson and Bard are beginning to lose lawsuits now in the million-dollar ranges.
Yes.
And at some point, I mean, are there profits from sales of this offsetting that, and they just want to continue, or at some point will it be such a necessity to just stop doing it?
Your timing on that question is very interesting. Johnson & Johnson just issued their fourth quarter 2015 earnings. They're eliminating 3,000 jobs in their medical device division and restructuring. So maybe that tells us something. I think fewer doctors are choosing this. The women certainly are getting more knowledgeable, and some of them hopefully are not buying the line that it's a different mesh, because I hear from some of these women. And hopefully use is off from that peak of about 200,000 implants a year. That's frightening stuff. And again, it's international. It's global. It isn't just in the U.S.
And Jane Akrey, you did mention before that this is not the only way to handle this kind of medical condition, medical problem, and there are other more holistic ways of dealing with it, albeit one might suggest less profitable, but there are other ways to handle these situations.
Yes.
And the interesting thing that you mentioned is that when this mesh, it's not inert, it has its own life kind of its own when it gets in someone's body. And the thing that stands out is then that there are all these other complications that develop after people have this mesh in them for some time. And, you know, one of the responses, it seems, of the medical industry is to kind of throw their arms up and say, well, we're not sure where that came from, but it's another problem to treat, I suppose. They have this treating the problem rather than looking at the causes. And then some of the cures actually end up being more of a problem. And that sounds a little bit like what you're saying here.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you can't really live on morphine for the rest of your life or oxycodone. That's not sustainable.
Well, Big Pharma would like that.
Gee, yeah.
I'm reading here, too, that there's doctors who specialize in mesh revision surgery.
There are a few. There are not that many. I mean, it used to be every...
Urogynecologist?
Not only urogynecologists. I mean, it used to be that everybody could be trained into putting this stuff in. They have cadaver clinics where the preceptors would train other doctors on how to implant it. Well, you know, cadavers don't move very much. They make wonderful patients. In the real world, it's a different situation. But then when you get to the real experts who are needed to remove this stuff, they are few and far between. And, you know, women will call me and say, well, I can't travel to St. Louis. I can't travel to Atlanta. And I'm like, you may have to, because you don't want an amateur hacking away in your vital area there, you know?
No, I think you just came up with a new slogan for Johnson & Johnson's mesh, you know, perfect for cadavers. It's pretty amazing, though, that you're chronicling this, you're writing about this. Can you tell people where they can follow some of this or point to a few other resources so that listeners can go and see what you're finding about this? Because this has not been covered very well in corporate media.
No, you're so right. I mean, when there's a multimillion dollar award, yes, Bloomberg will jump on it, and, you know, everybody sort of echoes it down the road. But no, nobody is covering this. And again, I don't understand why. I mean, I do understand their advertising, that they don't want to lose advertising dollars. But it's an amazing story. The website, it's been up 4.5 years now. It's meshnewsdesk.com. And there are a number of groups that, you know, citizens have gotten very active. Links on Mesh on Facebook is another group. Scottish Mesh Survivors, they're doing amazing work there. They actually petitioned their parliament and had a hearing, and they got the use of it curtailed. They have a better system there because the government can listen directly to the citizens. We need a congressional hearing here. We need to be able to speak directly to Congress and say, stop this nonsense. This is insane. But we don't really have that. So, again, it's meshnewsdesk.com. And on Facebook, there's a couple of links on Mesh. Mesh Me Not is another one on Facebook. Scottish Mesh Survivors. Just put that in the search on Facebook, and you'll see the stories that women talk about. And I started Mesh News Desk putting a face on adverse events because I thought that was a really chilly way of describing problems. And so I used to do a number of profiles. The lawyers have put the kebab on that. But you can read the actual stories. Use the search bar there and look up the profiles of people and how they fell into this very deep, dark place.
Jane Akrey, is there anybody that you know of in Congress that has an ear for this issue?
Good question. You know, Grassley, I suppose, would be the first choice. Claire McCaskill might be another one. You know, I haven't focused on that so much. I'm still generating the information.
Well, getting information to these people seems to be a key step at some juncture.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would think that the female members of Congress might be most interested in it, though.
Well, Jane, I'm reading here, too, that FDA has issued warnings to the public that complications are associated with surgical mesh, but that's probably not enough. I mean, people just don't know. And doctors see this, I think, as an easy way to proceed and protect someone when there's other possibilities and that. So, Jane, you're a longtime advocate for human health in a variety of ways, and you've certainly been working on this now for several years. Much appreciated.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for the opportunity to get the word out.
And we're glad to do this show, and this will air on 32 stations, and more people will become aware of it.
Peter and Mickey, thank you all for what you do. It's vital to have media literacy in this country.
Jane Akery, thank you, too, and we'll certainly be catching up with you more. We'll be paying attention to your work, and we'll have you back for an update on this mesh issue in the future.
Thank you all. Stay well.
You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. That was an interview with journalist Jane Akery. Up next, we're going to continue our program with Ken Burrows, who's an educator and a consultant for over 30 years, who teaches holistic health at San Francisco State University. So we're going to be talking a little bit more about health-related issues, but not just physically. We're going to be talking about it societally. So please stay with us. We'll return with Ken Burrows after this brief musical break.
Everybody talking about this war and that war. Who's for and not for? The last war, the next war, and nuclear is not for. And what for? Damn love war. Childish, man. Rubbish.
All we are saying is give peace a chance. All we are saying.
Everybody talking about Jewish and Arabish, Irish and Catholic, militant and immigrant. Them all human, you say, sir? Them all man. Childish. Childish. Peace, brother. Peace.
All we are saying.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Well, on the first segment of the program today, we talked about some health-related issues. And our next guest is certainly no stranger to these topics. Ken Burrows is an educator and consultant for over 30 years, teaching holistic health studies at San Francisco State University. He's the founder and director of the Holistic Health Learning Center, a unique interdisciplinary library and community action center integrating personal, social, and environmental aspects of health. And since 2001, he's organized the Gandhi King Season for Nonviolence, a 64-day educational campaign demonstrating that nonviolence can empower our personal and collective lives. And that 64-day period is January 30 to April 4. Ken Burrows will talk to us a little bit more about that in this segment. And of course, I already gave away sort of the link to the last segment. We're talking about holistic health here and being holistic as a culture. And when we talk about integrating personal, social, environmental aspects of health, again, there are a few people that we know that can speak more expertly about this than Ken Burrows. And Ken Burrows, welcome back to the Project Censored Show. You've been on several times, and in fact, every year we try to have you on during this Gandhi King Season for Nonviolence. Can you tell our listeners a little more about that?
Oh, glad to. Hi, Mickey. Hi, Peter. It's great to be back. Well, this season, so-called, it's a season because it has a length to it. As you might have noticed, it's about 9 weeks long between January 30th and April 4th. It happens to be between the memorial dates, or if you will, the assassination dates of both Gandhi and King. And those 9 weeks become a spring ritual, at least in our campus, of practicing what it means to be more caring, more loving, and being in life in a more meaningful way. And how do we bring wise action to daily life by looking at these two great exemplars and the other disciples that followed their nonviolent activism into the world, Chavez, And on. The list is fairly long now as this tradition has rooted itself in our planet. So this 9 weeks becomes practice period of literally trying on some of these new ways of being, recognizing that we all come from a cultural past that's violent, and how do we really own the higher or better aspects of our humanity and bring them into our institutions and our daily lives. So the first 3 weeks of this so-called season for nonviolence is a focus on our personal lives, on our inner life in particular. And often the thoughts I have that are judgmental or blame-oriented or shame-oriented, and how do I begin to orient my own inner life in a more effective way that's more productive and more caring, more meaningful. And then the second 3 weeks are focused on others. How do we really communicate and relate well with others, especially those we have significant relationships with? And then the final 3 weeks are focused on our own relationship with the world itself, with our earth, with the eco-social dimensions of a practice and connection.
So, Ken Burroughs, what do you anticipate comes out of this each time you do this each year? What's one of the goals that you try to get out of this series of speakers and workshops that you hold?
That's a great question. Well, at one level, to really correct the misunderstanding about what nonviolence is, most of us really see nonviolence as something rather passive, as just the absence of violence. And many of us see that as unrealistic. It's just we tend to use the term nonviolence in three different ways. One, that mere absence of violence, and that does not define nonviolence as Gandhi gave it to us, which I'll be glad to define in a minute. But the other two definitions for nonviolence, another one also as cloudy and unclear, is the basic avoidance of any recourse to physical violence as a strategy. That's also limited and has reference to no real deep philosophical or spiritual foundations other than avoidance of violence. Often this form of nonviolence is seen as conditional. If it doesn't work, we can go back to violence. This is, again, a passive approach. It defines nonviolent as really not using violence. The third style of nonviolence, which is more the Gandhian approach and really helps us redefine activism itself, is principled nonviolence. Gandhi had this basic theory that basically nonviolence is based on the assumption that human nature has a higher aspect and tends to respond to the advances of love and engaged and caring relationship, that we expect to be treated violently if we give someone else violence. It's a cycle of violence. And if you actually respond to violence with something that's more loving and not reactive but creative, it often throws the perpetrator off balance and leads them to actually begin to be somewhat teachable in some cases.
Could you describe that sort of as principled civil disobedience as well?
To some degree, although I think people define that differently, Peter, according to whoever's carrying that definition. I know with Gandhi, the very word nonviolence, that the English word we use, nonviolence, is really a poor translation of what he talked about. Ahimsa is the term in Sanskrit. Himsa means the desire to harm another. So ahimsa is in Sanskrit, it's a double negative. It's actually a strongly positive term. So ahimsa doesn't equate with nonviolence as it does in English. It's more of a positive desire for well-being of everyone. It's the engagement in well-being, and it's not just a neutral behavior in any way. I'm more about the loving concern for others and really the unattached side of love, just really engaging from that place. It throws someone who is typically centered in violence off center, and it gives occasionally some chance for dialogue.
We're speaking with Ken Burroughs. He is at San Francisco State University, an educator, a consultant for over 30 years, teaches holistic health studies there. We're speaking about a series he's been doing for the last 15 years called the Gandhi King Season for Nonviolence there. And he's also on the board of directors for Media Freedom Foundation and has done work with Project Censored for years. And his students have contributed numerous stories to our books every year. So Ken Burroughs, you mentioned ahimsa. Could you please talk more about that? I find that concept incredibly fascinating and enlightening. And can you talk to us more about it in that context of nonviolence?
Certainly. Gandhi basically saw an ecological model of life long before it became popular. He, King, Chavez, all of the others that tend to use this principled nonviolent approach to activism, the whole purpose is really to highlight injustice, and with that, the steps toward creative change. So you can do that by actually being something very different than the oppressor. Principled nonviolence, it's all violence, not just physical violence, is held to really to violate this essential interconnectedness of life. And it's that connectedness that also guarantees the eventual success of principled nonviolent action. this pursuit of peace by peaceful means. King called it the beloved community. How do we really find our way into the connection that reminds us we're part of this community of life? And you begin by actually practicing agape, or this love of the enemy. So there are basically two hands of nonviolence. In one hand, you're saying, no, this oppression that I'm experiencing is not appropriate, and I'm going to highlight it by my unwillingness to go along with it, the whole refusal to engage in injustice when you see it happening. And on the other hand, you raise an outstretched hand or arm, and you welcome the perpetrator with love and sympathy, often for their ignorance and for they're just often perhaps unaware of what they're causing. So with one hand we say no, with the other hand we say, but I understand, and you're certainly, we don't identify you with your behavior. So there are core principles that I could speak about too if you're interested, that both King and Gandhi came to, that are all part of this larger...
Ken Burroughs, yes, please do expand on some of those. I know I was thinking earlier when you says one of the King's quotes that an injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Please go a little deeper.
Well, another interesting King quote, the aftermath of violence is tragic bitterness and reaction, while the aftermath of nonviolence is a beloved community. So if we can somehow stand up to injustice and mirror the injustice so it can be seen, hopefully by the perpetrator, but certainly by all those around, and that the larger mirror of that action can begin to reflect in what culture can do, then change becomes possible from a place that's more insightful rather than reactive. Gandhi had some very specific principles for nonviolence. As I say, his first principle is all life is one. Everything is connected. The second core principle is that each of us has a piece of the truth and the untruth. And then human beings are always more than the evil they commit. And the means must be consistent with the ends, whatever we're doing. And we're called to celebrate both our differences and our fundamental unity. And then finally, we transform us versus them through our thoughts and actions. And this is, of course, what nonviolent activism does. And this oneness calls us to really work for the well-being of everyone and really translates whatever's going on into a very different language for action. Now, King had his own set of principles. They're different but related. He basically was saying that you must realize that nonviolence is a way of life for courageous people. You can't enter into nonviolent activism without being willing to take on the abuse that will typically come from their reaction of breaking an established pattern. Even if that pattern is unjust, it'll be resisted. So this is what happens in every society, is the people step forward to point out the resistance, often get injured or often murdered. And the hope is that we can arrange a situation so that's less likely to happen, but at times, you know, even murder can happen. So you have to be courageous to stand up to injustice and to really point it out in a way that's also likely to be seen and felt even by the perpetrator. And King went on to say that nonviolence seeks to win friendship and understanding, primary action, and that it's really a way of defeating injustice, not of defeating people. Also that nonviolence holds that this voluntary suffering of really educating others is by its nature transformative to all of those that watch it. And then finally that nonviolence clearly chooses love instead of hate, and that eventually the universe is on the side of justice, that long arc of moral justice that King talked about. Eventually, we move toward insight into what is just and right and appropriate for people.
Certainly, the idea of a beloved community, love for the enemy, agape, ahimsa as a philosophy, mm-hmm. and you're celebrating this in over a 9-week period, focusing on the self, others, and the world and the earth, is important work. But in the two cases, of course, that you're talking about, Gandhi and King, both were assassinated.
Right.
King by, according to William Pepper, the Memphis police and military intelligence. And the response from their deaths, of course, was violent responses in many communities around the country. So is it the effectiveness of what they were doing that so challenges and brings about a violent response?
I'm not so sure you would call it. Certainly they were effective, and that's, I'm sure, a big part of why they were murdered. In both cases, they helped to really create tremendous change in their cultures. I mean, when King was killed, he was pretty well known as the moral voice of that age. And I think that's what they're simply trying to do, and they recognize again that it takes courage to stand up and really speak truth to power, and you have to be prepared for that. And they took it on. They took it on willingly, and they paid a high cost for doing it, certainly.
We're speaking with Ken Burroughs, and we're talking about his series, From Gandhi to King. And he has a series of talks that happen at San Francisco State University between January and April. We'll be back to continue our conversation with Ken Burroughs after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with Ken Burroughs, an educator and consultant for over 30 years, teaching holistic health studies at San Francisco State University. He is also the founder and director of the Holistic Health Learning Center. He is also the organizer of the Gandhi King Season for Nonviolence, a 64-day educational campaign demonstrating that nonviolence can empower our personal and collective lives. And Ken Burroughs, certainly we've riffed around this quote from Martin Luther King on justice in 1967 while addressing the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Dr. King gave a talk, "Where Do We Go From Here?" And that's where this quote comes from, at least in this iteration. He was, of course, borrowing from several others in the previous century. But King said, "When our days become dreary with low hovering clouds of despair, and when our nights become darker than a thousand midnights, let us remember that there is a creative force in this universe working to pull down the gigantic mountains of evil, a power that is able to make a way out of no way and transform dark yesterdays into bright tomorrows. Let us realize the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." And talk a little bit more about that, Ken, and I know you wanted to share a story about Martin Luther King and his trip to India.
And also it connects to the question Peter had earlier. We have to be wise in the use of nonviolence, and we have to do it to be effective anyway. We have to do it and be aware of actual media coverage. To stand up to injustice and have no one see it, it's not the purpose behind this kind of activism. It's actually to inform community leaders and others. That's a big part of why we do this, is to have breakthroughs and understanding about a larger understanding of life. In fact, violence, as I see it, is just part of the fragmentation of our current culture, and the movement from violence is toward wholeness. And I think that's what King was alluding to, is this wholeness is our eventual parking spot or a resting spot, this hidden wholeness that we have all around us that we're blind to because of the stories that we're living out and through. And yet these stories are real for us, and they're affecting and shaping our culture. So the story is a brief one, but it happened. King, after his successes in the South, especially in Memphis and Birmingham, was honored in India by a Gandhian prize that they give there, and he flew to India to receive the prize. And as he announced what he had done and was admonishing other activists in the crowd, and there are people from various parts of the world that came, they were wondering about this form of activism that seemed to be taking root also in America. And among the crowd were two South Africans who were there, and they met with King afterwards, and they said, we fear going back to our culture because in the United States you have a constitution, you have some social agreements, you have a somewhat free press. And so when you take these actions, larger groups of people are informed, and they are, in fact, part of your protection. And we don't have that where we live. There is no such constitution. We have no such rights. And if we go back and try to foreground what a just culture looks like by standing up to injustice, we may, in fact, be killed. And that was their fear. So he admonished them to go back and to do that claimed again this idea of the long moral arc. And they did go back to South Africa, and they both were killed later in their attempts to create a more just culture. And eventually, it did happen in South Africa, but with a much larger effort that eventually mushroomed out, including many in our own country and a larger movement. So I think a big part of Gandhian thinking, and certainly as King has evolved the Gandhian theory, it's really all about movement building. It's about, first of all, relationship building as the primary tool in movement building, and also this reliance on truth. In fact, Gandhi had, a Sanskrit term, satyagraha, holding on to truth, which is satya, and, you know, truth or real or good, and then graha is to grab, is to hold. So this Sanskrit term that Gandhi used in 1908 really sort of defined half of his movement, that this force of truth is something we can trust, that it will affect people when they see it. And us standing up to injustice is somehow an announcement of this truth that has been somehow missed in the culture. And just the revelation of that truth itself, the pursuit of it and the revelation of it, will be its own way of helping the demise of that injustice.
So, Ken, you were linking nonviolence and the effectiveness of it to media coverage to a
Absolutely.
Certain extent.
Yeah.
And in an era where corporate media is negligent and deliberate about not covering effective actions or misrepresenting them, it would seem that that diminishes that power.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also the aspect of the individual and their transformation as they engage in these activities.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a broader concept that Gandhi talked about in terms of non-cooperation, a spirit of we're just not going to mm-hmm. cooperate with the British government or, in our case, the American government war machine,
mm-hmm.
and that we could effectively bring it to a standstill if enough people decided that they weren't going to cooperate. Even though the corporate media didn't cover it, it would seem that there's still options and possibilities there as well.
I think you've said it fairly clearly. Those are the two hands of nonviolence. The first really speaking some truth to power, but doing it skillfully. On the other hand, just acknowledging our connection. And I think you can see this in a present campaign to some degree. I think Bernie Sanders' campaign, he doesn't seem to react to some of the possibilities to take Hillary Clinton to task, as an example. He seems to be willing to step back and continue with his own message rather than move into attack. This is certainly in the direction of nonviolent activism, really pointing out injustice and really not blaming or shaming someone who might be part of that system.
And Ken Burroughs, interestingly, you mentioned Bernie Sanders and the campaign there. The corporate media ignored him for a long time.
Absolutely.
And then he didn't take the bait when he was attacked. And interestingly enough, one of the things that happened that kind of did catapult him into more prominence in the corporate news media, there's been several social movements and things in the past several years, whether it was Arab Spring or Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter. And, of course, that was part of one of the movements that prompted Sanders to address serious issues of racial inequity and so forth. So in your estimation, do you see what's happening now with, say, a Sanders candidate? Is there a movement here? Is this the culmination of many things that have been happening over the past 5 to 10 years that are kind of coalescing? Do you see this as part of a grassroots influence trying to come up through while the corporate-controlled parties try to keep that message out?
I think that's pretty clear that it is. I think despite the clear establishment media message that, I mean, if you look at the latest issue of Time magazine or Wall Street Journal, you can see who they favor by the quality of pictures they have in the dialogue, certainly on the pages that are presented, certainly the front page.
Well, from the New York Times to Saturday Night Live, they've been very clear about their support for
Hillary
Clinton.
Absolutely, and they keep trying to make it very unlikely that Bernie will have a chance to really pull off anything. And yet we see through this. We increasingly see through establishment media, and we have less and less faith in it. And I think that speaks for the people, and I think it speaks for what Gandhi said, this whole idea of the force of truth that shines through, and especially if there's a constancy of lack of integrity and coverage, that people start looking elsewhere for how to think and find that truth. And so One thing that I find the campaign, back to that movement building, Gandhi was much more, I think, this is where I think Bernie and his movement, our collective movement, if it becomes that, Gandhi was very much a constructive activist. I met with Gandhi's grandson, Arun Gandhi, at one point, and he said, my grandfather had something he said at home, but he didn't know if it was ever taken out in the public. He said that true nonviolence as an activist form is 90% constructive and 10% resistive. It means we do resist those things, those evils in the world, those inappropriate ways, but our whole idea is to move toward constructing a future that makes more sense, is more vital, more alive, and more abundant. So why waste too much time on really negating so much that's wrong in the world? And I think Bernie's still a little stuck on some of that, but appropriately naming what's wrong, certainly with the banking establishment, with the corporate world. But how do we get a focus also on really moving toward a better world that we all want and need?
Well, Ken Burroughs, I just wanted to say as well, we're not campaigning for Bernie Sanders here.
No, we're not.
I just want to be clear about that. And Bernie certainly has some policy stances that go against nonviolence, whether it's Israel or drone strikes and so forth. But it's interesting that we're focusing on some parts of that campaign and some parts of the narrative that do overlap with this Gandhi King season of nonviolence to some degree. We're going to have to wrap up the segment here. This is a 9-week period, San Francisco State University. Where can people find out more? Can people learn more about it online? Can people that don't live in the area somehow to tie into that?
Let me give you the website. You can simply Google Holistic Health Learning Center and find your way to the Holistic Health Learning Center, and there you can click on the Season for Nonviolence, and there you'll find a number of documents that will help you understand much more about nonviolent activism, about really understanding this whole movement.
Well, Ken Burroughs, thank you so much for joining us on the Project Censored show today. And thank you for all the work you've been doing at San Francisco State University with the wonderful students there that work with Project Censored every year. And for your 15th year here with the Seasons of Nonviolence, Gandhi King. So thank you for all the work you do, and we'll certainly be catching up with you again in the near future.
You bet, Nikki. Thanks to you both.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came.
That's our program for today. We'd like to thank all of you for joining us. The Project Censored Show airs on 32 stations around the United States. For more information and to listen to archives of previous shows, go to www.projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. If you'd like to learn more about how to bring the Project Censored Show to your community, please contact us through our website at projectcensored.org. Thanks to Anthony Fest, our producer. Erica Bridgman is our engineer. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We'll see you next time.
Created by the criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guise, democracy, politics, of the apocalypse, got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison, genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxes, while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing, all the prisons, filled with capacity citizens, and the times for the master thief, divine conquer, steal a masterpiece, open your eyes and realize what's happening, time's running out to reach all potential fame, at the table then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love, we got the brothers and our sisters.